This is SB Nation AM.
Another kind of daytime radio program.
On SB Nation Radio.
And on SBNationRadio.com.
Presented by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage is with you every step of the way. Live from the O'Reilly Auto Parts Studios, alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, thanks for joining us. It is hour number two as we roll along on a Thursday, a throwback Thursday nonetheless. Ron Culver still on vacation as we continue along this week. John Elway and the Denver Broncos are going to start training camp. They get ready for the Hall of Fame game. Elway, speaking yesterday, said, finally satisfied with the quarterback position. You know what? You said this before, John. You said this before. Listen, Joe Flacco is an upgrade from Case Keenan, but I'm not sure that this is now the guy you're satisfied with. What people want from the starting quarterback, and what they wanted you to do with the starting quarterback position, is groom a guy that is going to be the starter quarterback for years and years and years down the road. Find the guy in the draft, nurture him, develop him, and then lock in the guy that's going to be the quarterback or the franchise quarterback for 10 years. Now, that's very difficult to do, and a lot of it is a crapshoot, but the rotation of quarterbacks since Peyton Manning has left has not done John Elway any favors. And Elway has felt good about every single one of the quarterbacks that has come through. The only quarterback he has not liked since he took the job was Tim Tebow. He never warmed up to Tebow. I remember I was there in all of the Tebow mania in Denver covering that team on a daily basis. And when the crowd would lose its mind when Kyle Orton would be playing terrible and Tim Tebow was on the bench, and then Tebow would come in, throw the ball all over the place, not hitting his receivers, and then in the final 2 minutes, work some incredible magic, and the Broncos would eke out a victory. John would just go, ugh. He liked the winning, but he didn't like what the winning could mean, because that wasn't his guy. And that's why he went hard after Peyton Manning, not just because it's Peyton Manning, but because, hey, we didn't really have an answer. The answer that I had was this guy that led us to the playoffs that I knew was not going to be the long-term answer. But Trevor Siemian was supposed to make you feel good. Brock Osweiler was supposed to make you feel good, right? Paxton Lynch was supposed to make you feel good. You drafted him in the first round. Case Keenum, you gave big money to. That was supposed to make you feel comfortable that you had it locked in the quarterback position. Now you trade for Joe Flacco, who lost his job to Lamar Jackson. And now you're supposed to feel good. Listen, I've gone down this road with you many times. I know you haven't gotten your guy, and I know you're trying to sell this. Keep selling hard. Joe Flacco could be great, but right now I don't feel he's the answer. SB Nation Radio.
It's Thursday, which means it's Throwback Thursday on SB Nation AM. Live from the O'Reilly Auto Parts Studios, alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
Right, we're celebrating a British Open Championship. Players who have won on this date through the years. Are we at 99 now, Gio? 1999?
Yes,
this is my favorite British Open. This was won by Paul Laurie in a playoff with Justin... I'll have to look that up, but I know John Vandeveld was in it, because this is the one of the most famous British Open collapses. It goes back to a kind of a cliche we have in sports. It's sometimes you win a championship and you're forgotten, and sometimes somebody loses a championship and they're remembered forever. And that's the case of Jean Vandeveld, the Frenchman at Carnoutsi, who battled all the odds. He was ranked like 150th player in the world. And for whatever reason, and however reason, we still will never know. He had a 3-shot lead sitting on the 18th tee at Carnoutsi with a chance to win the British Open. First Frenchman to win the British Open. Everybody else was over par, even Tiger Woods. It was a tough day, tough course. Winds were blowing all over the place. Course was playing very difficult. And Vandeveld played pretty much out of his mind for 71 holes and then lost his mind on the 72nd hole. When you have a 3-shot lead, your golfers talk about this a lot, where they don't want to look at the scoreboard. You know, they say, some guys do. Some guys want to know exactly where they are at all times. Some don't. They just want to play their game and be aggressive. What got me here? You know, dance with what the woman who brought you here, right? So if they played an aggressive game, they stay aggressive. If they played a conservative game, they stay conservative. Well, Vandeveld played pretty aggressive. He played out of his shoes. He was, again, not ranked very high, got into the tournament, and was making the most of the opportunity of being in the tournament. And the 18th hole at Carnoustie is a very tough hole. You've got water going in different areas, and also you had a wind that was blowing in all different directions, and it would switch up. It was a very, very tough day. And what does Vandeveld do on the tee, on the 18th hole with a three-shot lead? Remember, this is two shots he can waste, right? Two shots he can waste. He hits a driver. Now, Peter Allis, the great golf announcer, immediately knew this was wrong. Sound like this. And nobody really did. You don't hit driver when you have a three-shot lead and you need a double bogey to win the championship. You could hit 7-iron, 7-iron, and 7-iron and be on the green and two-putt for a bogey. You do not need to hit driver, but he hit driver anyway. And he pulled it off to the right. Now, he didn't go into the water, but he ended up on the 17th fairway. Now, at that moment, okay, you're clear. You're on dry land. You've flirted with the devil, and you won. At that moment, still a three-shot lead, you would think he would say, okay, caddy, I blew that. I shouldn't have hit driver. I got away with it. Let's do something smart and safe, and let's get out of here with the claret jug. So what does he do? He pulls out a 2-iron. A 2-iron that really nobody can hit, including pros. And it's, again, windy. It's dry. What does he do? Bonk. Hits the grandstand. It goes into the rough. So now he's got his third shot from the deep rough. Deep British Open rough. Again, three-shot lead. Everybody's in the clubhouse. So he gets to the rough. Now, what has he got in front of him? He's got the burn, the water in front of him. He's got a bunker. He's got a green. He's got fairway. Still got a good ways to go. But he's got to get it out of the rough. The rough is impossible. It's going to grab the club. It's going to make it really hard to hit. You know, he can't fluff it up like we do. You know, you're like, oh, I'll give myself a really good lie here. He has to hit it where it lies, and it's lying pretty deep. So this is his third shot. Remember, he's got a three-shot lead. What does he do? Boom, splash. It goes into the burn. And everybody's going crazy. You can watch this on YouTube, by the way. It's really unbelievable. So now he's in the water. So he goes to the water, and what does he do there? Just to add to the drama of going into the water. Remember, again, and I keep saying this because you need to keep remembering this, it is a three-shot lead to win the claret jug. Anyway, he then goes off with the shoe, off with the socks, off with the shoe, off with the socks, goes into the water to assess whether or not he should hit the ball out of the water. At one point, Peter Allis is like, somebody, please stop this. Please get to him and make him not do this. He can't do this. He's in the water assessing this, and place is buzzing like, he's not going to hit it out of the water, is he? He's not that crazy, is he? Like, hitting a ball out of the water is really tough, but it's not like he's in a small, shallow pond. He's in a burn. They cut out the burn. The burn, it's got this wall in front of him. He's got to fluff it out of the water. And he's in there with a club, and he's looking at the ball, and he goes, all right, I'm not going to hit it out. He grabs the ball, and he takes his drop. All right, so now, now he's hitting his fifth shot. Now remember, if he makes a six, he wins the British Open. So he takes his drop, and now all he's got to do is hit it close and make a putt. And he wins the British Open. And all of this will be forgotten, and it's dumb. He knocks it into the bunker. He hits it into the front bunker. So now he's in the bunker. Now you got to think at this point, his ears are burning. He's probably like embarrassed. He knows the world is watching. He's really screwed this up. He hit driver, hit 2-iron. These were the dumbest decisions you could make. He goes into the bunker, hits it out to 8 feet, which, by the way, is a miracle in and of itself. At that point, I'm surprised he didn't scull it across the green or miss. And then he drains the putt for a 7 that gets him in the playoff. It gets him in a playoff. And he loses the playoff to Paul Laurie. But nobody remembers Paul Laurie. They remember Jean Vandeveld. Now, it raises an interesting question. if you ask the player, would you rather win the British Open and be forgotten or be go down in flames like this and always be remembered? They'll always take the trophy. They'll always say, well, fame is not what I'm into. I'm into personal achievement. I'd want to win the British Open, of course. But in a way, it's got to be somewhat satisfying if you can just get over the fact that you blew this. This is your infamy. You didn't win the British Open and become forgotten. You will always be remembered. They still go back. When the tournament goes back to Carnoutsi, they still bring him up. They still talk about him. And a lot of it is positive over the years. A lot of the stuff, you know, you could, oh, he choked. It's one of the biggest choke jobs, all of that. But it gets polished up over the years. Now people are doing these retros. And The Ringer actually had a really good article about this today. They're doing these retros where instead of saying what a moron he was, what an idiot he was, how, you know, what a dumb move his caddy should have broke, like Tin Cup, should have broke the driver over his knee. You're not going to hit this. No chance. That 2-iron, that's dead too. You're going to hit 5-iron, 5-iron wedge, and we're going to win the trophy. But instead it's being polished as, you know what? How in the world did he make a 7? How did he make a 7? More or less, shouldn't it have been a 9 or a 10 or 11? He was playing, he was hitting such bad shots that you wouldn't have been surprised if he was in the bunker and he hit it to 30 feet and 4-putted. Or he hit it over the green because he was so, his heart rate was going through the roof. Or he left it in the bunker, hit too much underneath it. The fact that he got up and down from the bunker in probably the most precious situation, because it's not just trying to get into a playoff, it's trying to redeem yourself. He's not trying to get up and down and trying to win a tournament where he's got to make this incredible par. He's embarrassed himself in front of the world, and he's like, I need a second chance at this. The only way I'm getting a second chance at this is if I knock this close and make the putt. And he knocked it to within 8 feet, and he made the putt. And that is being seen today, 20 years later, as really the more redeemable thing about John Vandeveld rather than the stupidity of making these horrible, horrible decisions. But that to be remembered in that way, I think it's got to be, I know it sounds crazy, but it's got to be a little bit appealing. Just like, hey, you know what? Certainly I'd like to have the claret jug, but you know what? If I can laugh at myself at this, if I can move past this, if I can enjoy this, it's people really do like remembering it. Like you go to YouTube, you can watch it on YouTube. It's incredible. It's just watching the crowd go, what is he doing? How is this happening? What are you talking about? Is he going to go in that water and hit that ball? It's amazing. And 20 years ago. That's what happened. So, little retro, little throwback Thursday for you as we celebrate the British Open. All right, coming up, we'll talk some NFL as the Madden results are in. And boy, people really take that seriously. That's coming up next, SB Nation AM.
It's Thursday, which means it's Throwback Thursday on SB Nation AM. Live from the O'Reilly Auto Parts Studios, alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
Thanks for joining us, SB Nation Radio, SB Nation AM, as again we roll along on a Throwback Thursday. All right, so as we continue along, these are champions that were crowned on this date in the British Open. This is 2004. I don't know the song, Gio, so you're going to have to play Name That Tune. Go ahead.
This is Usher.
Usher, excellent. All right.
Yeah. I knew the 2000s might get you.
That's right. It does get me a little bit. That's all right.
I'm sure you'll get the next one.
All right, but this is 2004. Todd Hamilton. Was this at Royal Troon where he won the British Open?
I believe so.
Yeah, I believe he won at Troon. I think Mickelson was in the running for this. Todd Hamilton is another one of those British Open champions that you go, I don't know who that is. He's a champion, but I don't know who that is. Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. We're close, convenient, known for our guaranteed everyday low prices. Excellent customer service from the professional parts people that you can trust. Stop by your local O'Reilly Auto Parts today. O'Reilly Auto Parts, better parts, better prices every day. Before I get to this Madden story. So, yeah, I've been dealing with this cold for the last couple of days. I've been trying this different kind of medication. And I'm not sick, but I have like a cough, which drives me nuts. But yesterday I wanted to run. I wanted to go for a jog. And my wife said, don't do it. You're not feeling, you know, great. You're coughing. I said, nah, maybe I'll sweat this out a little bit more. So I went for a jog. And the reason I went for a jog is because on my vacation, I went on a cruise with my family. And I went with my father and my mother, my sister, my family. And we had a really great time. And I hadn't been on a cruise ship in a really long time. And I kind of forgot how many great food options are on a cruise. So I ate a lot. One day, I had three desserts, Gio. Three desserts. I ate gelato in like mid-afternoon. I had a dessert for like an afternoon snack, and then I had dessert at dinner like around 9:30. Three desserts in one day. I mean, it's like gluttony at its best.
That's not bad at all.
I ate so much that you could have taken a picture of me and you could have made a meme about how like other countries hate us. Like, look at this fat American just woofing down this big pile of food, drowning everything in ranch dressing. I mean, It was gluttony at its finest. I mean, I was eating everything. I mean, all the time.
Hey, Americans, save some food for the rest of us here.
I know, right? It was unreal. I mean, it was kind of embarrassing how much food I was eating. But they have it all the time. Like, you can go anytime and just get food. So I was eating food. So nevertheless, when I got home, you know, I weighed myself. I'm like, oh, boy, I gained some pounds. So I go out for a run. Half a mile into the jog, I'm huffing and I'm puffing. And I'm like, what did I eat? A bowling ball while I was on vacation? I can't move. Half a mile in. Now, I have gotten to the point where I can run 1 to 1.5 to 2 miles before I kind of get a little tired and have to slow down. Half a mile in, I'm like, I can't do this. I can't. And a lot of it was the heat, a little bit of the coughing. But I think a lot of it had to do was, yeah, this is what you get, man. This is what you get for stuffing your face on vacation.
Yeah, I mean, I went on vacation 2 weeks ago, and I felt the same way. I think I gained like six pounds or something like that.
Yeah, I gained a good amount.
Yeah, man.
I gained about six or seven. I was like, goodness.
I ate a lot, and then I've been busy ever since I came back. Today, or yesterday, was the first time I actually went for a run as well for the first time since I came back.
Well,
and
you probably were dying. Able to, but I bet you were able to still finish. Like, hey, whatever you run, you probably were able to accomplish it.
I mean, it was like
accomplishment.
It was like a mile.
Yeah,
because it was also like 95 degrees, and I didn't want to.
I thought I was going to vomit. I mean, I was like, I can't breathe through this thick soup, and the fact that I weigh a lot more. It was awful. It was absolutely awful. But nevertheless, I mean, listen, it is what it is. I gotta work hard. I gotta start from scratch, start all over again.
Were you coughing the whole time? Or?
No, I wasn't. It wasn't until I was really out of breath that then I, you know, as I stopped and was walking, then the coughing kicked in, and I was like, all right, maybe it wasn't a good idea.
And I hate the fact that all those fit people just like keep running past you and they like look back, like, is he okay?
It's terrible.
Is he? Do we need to call a hospital? An ambulance?
Yeah.
Like,
no. That's what I always said. There's a track down near my house. It's a big 1 mile walking track, right? And a lot of people run there. And I've run there many times. But I always feel like the fit people are just hanging around a little longer just to make sure I don't collapse and die on them. Like, they're lapping me and, you know, like, and they keep going around me. And I'm just wondering if they're looking at me going, yeah, maybe I should wait till he actually stops and gets to his car. Because, you know, if he's here by himself, there's going to be nobody to save him when he inevitably passes out from doing this.
Look, what you have to do is sprint. Don't run. You don't seem like you're not in shape if you sprint.
Yeah, that's true.
Because you're running a short distance. Like, anybody can run a short distance.
Yeah, when you're, chugging along at a slow jog. You know, the other thing, too, is, and I've made this comment many times. When you're overweight and you run, people they feel like they should give you encouragement, right? Like, I've gotten so many people who come up to me while I'm running, like after I run, they go, Hey man, let me tell you something. I saw you out there and I just want to say, good for you, man. Good for you. Go out there. You were killing it. I just wanted to tell you how you're just inspiring. You don't say that to fit people. You say that to fat people when they're exercising. You don't go up to people going, who are fit, and going, hey man, I saw you run 5 miles like you weren't doing anything. That was amazing to me. Good up. Keep it up. Keep it up, man. Keep it up. No, you do it to fat people because you like the idea that they're doing something rather than being sitting around being lethargic all day. I get that all the time when I go running.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like they think they're helping,
Yeah, but it's...
Like, my biggest fear is to be, like, that bench warmer. Like, when the bench warmer comes in and everybody's clapping and then you finally score and they're like, oh, my God,
oh,
yes.
They lose their minds.
Everybody loses
yeah.
their mind. Like, that's my biggest fear. Like, I want to be at least to that level where I score and I just get the... clap.
Yeah, like it's expected that you would score, right?
Exactly.
Because they respect your talent.
They exactly. they should respect my running. I don't know why random people would come up to me and give me encouragement. I don't really need it.
Yeah.
Even if you give me the encouragement, I'm probably not going to do this again tomorrow. All right? So it doesn't matter.
Yeah, you're going to see me here every day.
Like, you're still going to see me once a week. Like, no matter what you say, it's not going to make me it changed my lifestyle all the way, all
right? Right. So a number of NFL players have hit to Twitter to talk about their Madden ratings. I love this story. This happens every single year, doesn't it? When the Madden ratings come out and everybody goes, wait a minute, I only got an 89 in speed? What, are you kidding me? I may be coming off a torn ACL, but my God, I'm at least a 94. I love it. It's the power of this video game. I think the Madden video game has done a number of great things for the sport of football. One, I think it just provides a really cool entertainment addition to the NFL experience, right? We can watch the games, we can play fantasy football, but playing a video game with the players, with the stadiums, with the teams, it adds to the overall experience. It's a great game. It's a fun game. It's probably the to me, it's the best sports game around. I know people think the hockey game is really good and whatnot, but I personally, this is my favorite sports game. But also too, I think it's gone a long way to helping people really understand the game. And I think if you are dedicated to playing Madden, you are dedicated to learning what all the terminology is, right? You may know what a blitz is, et cetera, but it kind of forces you to look at these plays, know these plays. You hear it all the time with kids. They now know these plays by name. They know what the end is supposed to do. They know what linebacker is supposed to drop back in coverage. It's kind of neat to see. It helps you understand the game a little more. Now, I know we live in we still live in that era where we want kids to go out and play football rather than being inside and playing football. And I totally get that. You know, I put limits on my kids' video games when they were growing up, you know, only play for a certain amount of time and go out and get sunshine. But when they did go out and play football, you could see the influence of the Madden video games on the way my son and his buddies played pickup football. It was pretty cool to watch. But it's also neat to see something where pop culturally, something we enjoy, right, is also being enjoyed by the people that game represents, that they're as into it as we are into it. You know, we're fans of the league, we're fans of the sport, and people who play Madden are really, you know, have that additional fandom that is connected. But it also is cool to know that these athletes take it as seriously in a lot of ways. You know, maybe they're making a little bit of joke, but you can tell that they're like, wait a minute, I'm a 78 in this, I'm a 62 in this, I'm a 58 in this, I'm a 90 in this. Like, they're taking an interest in something that's really artificial, but at the same time is something we all kind of enjoy. We all kind of can play this game. Now, I don't play this game as much as I did back in the day. Sort of, you know, video games have sort of kind of, you know, went out of my system. But nevertheless, I've enjoyed this series for a very, very long time, right? I remember how good, you know, Bo Jackson was on Tecmo Bowl, and now I also remember how good Michael Vick was in Madden, right? Now they're saying that Patrick Mahomes is going to be as good in this game. Again, that's pretty awesome. You know, by embracing Madden, you've gotten to an audience. You're the NFL. This is one of the great things. Sports always worry if they're losing a generation. And if they are losing a generation, you know, how do you get them? Does the game have to change? What do you do? Well, this game has kept a lot of young people interested in the National Football League, right? It is, they like playing it. They like playing with their friends, and then they like watching it on TV. And with the graphics being as good as they are, my God, you hear it all the time. People like, I walked in my son playing Madden. I thought he was watching football. Like, I thought it was an actual broadcast. But it's neat to see, you know, all of, you know, Tack McKinley, right? Tyron Matthew. I mean, go, the list goes on Twitter about the Madden speed rating. Tom Brady making a joke about it. It's great. They even got the Tom Brady getting dissed with the high fives. That's pretty awesome. It's a great addition to the NFL lore.
SB Nation AM continues now on SB Nation Radio.
time for the good.
That's really nice.
The bad.
That's the bad guy.
And the dumb.
What an idiot. Oh, what a loser.
All right, this is the good, the bad, and the dumb. Ron Culver is on vacation, but Gio has stepped up with a couple of the stories to make the segment. So let's start with the good.
So the good, we go to the Atlanta League. Remember last week we talked about robot umpires?
Yeah, robot umpires, and they are also letting people steal first base. But the robot umpires was the big story.
Yes. Well, the good is that former Twins pitcher Frank Biola has stepped up for all human race going against this robot takeover.
So Frank Viola is arguing with the robot ump?
Yes, he got
good
ejected.
For him.
He got ejected.
Oh, that's the best.
Yes, he got ejected for arguing with the robot umpire, unquote. He got annoyed that the umpire working the home plate, who has the authority to overrule the system, didn't do so on several pitches.
Is he arguing with the process of the ump, or was he arguing with the actual computer?
Well, he was arguing that the computer was messing up and
got it,
and the ump wasn't overruling the pitch.
Oh, I gotcha. Okay, well, good for him, because here's the deal: when the computers come to get us all, we better start sticking up for ourselves, right?
Absolutely.
Frank Viola could lead the resistance. We could point to him and have him lead the resistance, so we don't all succumb to the overlords of the computer age.
Yeah, I mean, robots are taking everybody's jobs.
Yeah, they are. They're taking ump jobs. Well, the umpires are saying, now, wait a minute, I'll be needed at home plate. But in the end, he's not calling balls and strikes anymore. Now, the way they implemented it in the Atlantic League was that the home plate umpire would have to call a ball or strike if the computer glitched. So he had to be ready, and he had to be on top of it. That's not easy to do, man. Like, when you're not doing something, you just watch it. You're like, well, I'll watch this just in case. After a while, you do lose focus. Those guys have really, really are tuned in. But good for Frank Viola. I didn't know he was in the Atlantic League. That's dedication to baseball, man.
Well, he's a pitching coach.
He's a pitching coach in the Atlantic League?
Yeah.
I thought he'd be a head coach.
No.
He's Frank Viola, for crying out loud. What's he doing being a pitching coach in the Atlantic League?
Right? I don't even...
Like, shouldn't he be a pitching coach in, like, I don't know, the majors? It's Frank Viola, man. He was a good pitcher in his day.
Yeah, so according to the ejection report, with two out and two on, in the bottom of the first inning of the Rockers versus Revolution game, Revolution batter Ryan Dent took four balls from Rockers starting pitcher Dominique DeMasi around one swing and strike for a five-pitch walk. Following the at-bat, Viola was heard yelling at Dittweiler, the ump, to do your bleeping job. At the high point, pitching coach demanded the plate umpire step in to overrule the robot.
Oh, see, hold on. That's dangerous, right? Because the umps are going to get – the umpires are now in a position to overrule the call. But the reason you have the robots in the first place is that they can do a better job with the call. There shouldn't be this – now you're going to blame a guy for overruling a computer that we've all now looked at and said it does a better job than you do. That's a tough position for the umpire to be in.
Exactly.
The umpire is like, what am I supposed to do? Like, overrule it every now and then? What are you talking about?
I mean, it's so complicated.
It really is.
Yes, yeah, so I don't even know how.
I think it brings more trouble than it's worth. That might not make it up to the major league level. That's more trouble than it might be worth.
Do you think
to major league baseball?
You think there's a few kinks that needs to be worked out, or is it like,
yeah,
is it not going to work out at all?
Yeah, but here's the thing. And I hate to say it like this, because you always want to see if you can use technology to the betterment of the sport. But is umpires' balls and strikes and strike zones, is this something that is a major issue with Major League Baseball that they have to fix it? I mean, are players complaining that the strike zones are so inconsistent, and or are they kind of happy with the way it is?
Yeah, right? I feel like only one ump gets all the bad rap for missing balls and strikes.
Yeah, I mean, we'd want the game to be officiated or umped in a way that, you know, everything is as right as it can be. But the human element of the game is almost universally accepted in this situation. I don't think anybody loses their minds over it. Yeah, there are times, especially in key games, postseason games, where, you know, a pitcher just misses the corner, but it's called a strike, or it's right down the middle and it's called a ball. I mean, it's, you know, it. Yeah, but that's part of the game. I don't think people are clamoring for this to a point where they say we demand instant replay in the NFL was something, you know, years and years and years ago when it was first implemented. People really wanted it because they said, listen, some of these calls are really bad. We would love a way for instant replay to come in and help us correct these bad calls. But I don't think balls and strikes is something that we really are just going crazy over, that we demand that it be fixed enough for Major League Baseball to want this implemented. Again, if it gets fixed, if it gets better, then you probably will see it. But I can only imagine baseball going, yeah, you know, this might be more of a headache.
Yeah, I mean, out of the two rules, I think the stealing first base is clearly the best rule, right?
Like, that's freaky. Like, when you see it on video, like the first time it happens, you're like, this isn't supposed to happen, but it is kind of exciting. The idea that you could take first on any pitch, right? So you can be up at the plate, pass ball or anything, and you can go to first.
Well,
that adds a kind of a neat little element to the game.
Well, I mean, it takes some songs to steal base, steal first base while the pitcher has the ball in his hand.
By the way, I don't think there are many guys fast enough to go 90 feet, even if the ball goes to the backstop. I mean, there's like the Billy Hamiltons of the world. You know, the Billy Hamiltons of the world can make it. There's some fast guys, but not every guy is fast enough to go 90 feet. That ball goes to the backstop. Those catchers are on top of it, and they'll just sling it down there before in a blink of an eye.
Yeah, I mean, I feel because like that's
going to
be hard.
Don't we see that occasionally on a swinging third strike miss, but the ball gets behind the catcher?
Yeah, well, it gets dropped.
Right? Right. So the batter swings at a third strike. He's out, but he can go to first base on a pass ball and a swinging third strike. And we see it every now and then. Hardly anybody ever gets to first on those plays.
Well, they don't look back and see the catcher, but I get your point. Like, it's, you know, it's hard to outrun a ball in 90 feet. So, but I think that rule will stick and we'll make it to the
I agree.
To the majors.
All right, let's get to the bad.
The bad. Next time you're running, Tony, look out for those birds. U.S. bird attacks on humans are on the rise. According to
U.S. bird attacks? Like, what are we talking about? Like turkey vultures?
No, like birds.
Pigeons?
Like the movie Birds.
Oh my God, like the Alfred Hitchcock birds where they're all gathering and they're just waiting for fresh meat?
Yes, exactly like that.
Oh my goodness.
Bird attacks on humans are growing more common as people continue to encroach on bird nesting territory, wildlife experts warn. Mary Hyman was walking her dog around a lake in downtown Denver, Colorado, in late July when a bird started flying uncomfortably close to her head. Before she knew what was happening, the bird body slams you in the back of the head.
Oh, that's awful.
Frantically, and then goes back in the bush. So it's like, it's a hit and run.
Listen.
This bird hit and run this lady.
I got to worry about robots, and now I got to worry about birds. Why don't I just stay inside all day? I mean, my God. We'll get any sun.
Well, I mean, robots are inside your home as well. You got
that's
Alexas.
True.
You
got that's right.
Computers. Everything is inside your home already.
One time I was playing golf, and there was a geese, and they had laid eggs. You know how mothers get protective animals? Mothers get protective. And me and my buddy were playing golf, and we were walking off the tee, and we were walking past this goose that had eggs. And she thought we were a threat, and she came towards us, and she had her wings out, way out, ready to kind of attack. That was a really scary moment. And then my friend said that he hears like they've got like a bone on the end of their wings that could take off a chunk of your flesh. But we ran. I mean, we got out of there. That was very scary. There's nothing like when an animal has you in their sights, and then they're like, I'm going to come after you, and they don't give up on you. That, it's pretty frightening. But I don't want to know. No, I don't want any birds on my head. This is bad. This is bad news.
Absolutely.
Where are the birds getting off coming after humans? They should stay in their place. Stay in your lane, birds. Right? We like looking at you with binoculars. That's as far as we go. Come to my bird feeder, get fed, leave. I don't need you hanging around plotting my destruction. What is wrong with you?
That's
scary.
There's a website called Crow Tracks. And it reports violent incidents with crows in British Columbia. So,
oh, I bet the list is forever.
If you have, yes, 5,000 reports already.
Yeah. Yep.
So crows do not like humans for some reason. Ever since the movie.
Yep. All right. What's the dumb of the day?
So the dumb, I don't know if you saw this. On Tuesday, Kyle Schwarber hit a 2-run walk-off home run, right? And it landed on some netting of some sort over there. And you see the two kids trying to get to the ball.
Yep.
And they were close to grabbing the ball, but then a grown man ran up and snatched it away from them.
Snatched it away, yeah. He said, no, that's mine.
And then started celebrating while the kids were, disappointed.
He was probably like, you're going to fight over this. One of you is going to cry. Now you both cry. Bang. Yeah,
it's
done.
Life lesson. Well,
life lesson. Be an adult. You get the ball. Be a kid. You have to wait for somebody to give it to you.
Well, Mai Tai, that's what he is. His custom jersey says, was interviewed yesterday before the game. And this is what he had to say.
All right.
The kids are in the front row because we let them go there. You know what I'm saying? It's a gamer. You know, the rules here. You know, the Cubs can't be responsible for the absence of fans when trying to procure a home run or foul ball. Walk-off home run, kind of anybody's game. Feel bad for the kids, but it looked a lot worse than it really was. Not at all.
He's giving like parameters. As, all right, if it's this, it's this. And if it's this, it's game on. I'm going to go get it. Good for him.
No remorse.
No remorse
for this guy.
Listen, man. If you're gonna go bold. All right, we can hate you for it, but go bold. Stand on your laurels, even if we find them disgusting. At least he's standing up for what he believes in. Nope, that's a walk off. I'm taking it. That's great.
Would you let the kid have the ball?
Yes, I've done that once already.
I think like 90% of the U.S. population will let the kids have the ball.
Yes, exactly. I got a ball once. Got a ball player threw it. Well, it was I was in Colorado and I was a media and I just happened to be and the ball was thrown up and I ended up it fell. And I grabbed it and I gave it to a kid. This one of the players had just tossed it up and I just happened to be walking by and I got it. I just gave it to a kid. I could have kept it for my own kid, but I said no. I mean, that would look dumb. Here's a kid. I got it. I got the ball. He's throwing a bunch of them into the crowd.
Yeah, it's so. Like Seinfeld whenever... was it Seinfeld? Whenever he was stealing balls or something?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, no, you try to. The problem is that catching a ball or getting a ball at a game is really cool. And now we're kind of pressuring people to give it to kids. But it is a cool moment when you get one. But to get it from a kid when a kid's going for it, that's ridiculous. If you're going to get it, have it hit to you exactly, and you catch it, and it's yours. And you might give it to a kid, but you can also keep it. That's fair game. But if you're chasing little kids who are going after a ball, and you're getting it yourself because you're bigger and stronger and faster, the criticism's coming.
Yeah.
That's all
I
got to say.
I absolutely agree with you. Like, if you catch it, it's cool. You can keep it.
That's yours.
That's yours. But if it's a 50-50 ball, like, come on, bro.
Let the kids get it.
Let the kids have it.
That's
a memory.
That's right. All right. Good, bad, the dumb. It's a Thursday on SB Nation AM.
It's Thursday, which means it's Throwback Thursday on SB Nation AM. Live from the O'Reilly Auto Parts Studios, alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, 2010, right?
Yes.
That's where we're celebrating Louis Oosthuizen winning at St. Andrews.
This is
Katy Perry.
Sure
isn't Snoop Dogg in this?
Yes, he is.
Yeah, look at me. All right, give me applause for that.
Good job, man.
Yeah, I didn't know. I work. I work at it.
Snoop Dogg fan?
Wasn't this a response to Empire State of Mind with Alicia Keys?
Yes.
Right? They did a thing about him and her and Jay-Z did the song about New York, and then they said, let's do something about California to represent California. Isn't that, there's something about that that's connecting the two songs?
It wasn't like a beef. It was just like a little jab at New York, I guess.
Yeah,
because the State of Mind song was very not as upbeat as this one.
Yeah, that's very true. Very good song though. Very good song. Look, I'm no Ryan Seacrest, but I do the best I can to try to keep up with the music scene. Okay, I do the best I can.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you got a big Katy Perry catalog.
Yeah, right, sure. And my daughter liked her for a little bit, then moved on to other people and whatnot.
Well, just like America.
That's right. The British Open going on again in Scotland. Rory McIlroy, we got a little more news on how Rory McIlroy made an eight on the first hole. He hit the ball out of bounds. Then he hit his second shot. A third shot would be from the tee into the rough. Couldn't get it out. Hit it into the rough again. And then took an unplayable lie, hit it on the green, and two-putted. And that's how he made his eight, to open up the British Open. That's how he opened up the British Open on what is technically his home course, by making it eight on the first hole. There's a whole bunch of golfers at four under, Shane Lowry, Webb Simpson, Kevin Kisner. It's very early in the tournament. But the story is the anticipation of what it would be for Rory McIlroy to win at a course that he lives an hour away. And unfortunately, it doesn't look like it's going to happen, or he's going to be competitive. Now, if he comes roaring back after this quadruple bogey, and it looks like he's starting to make a little bit of a move. He's got a birdie at seven and a birdie at nine. So he's at three over. He's now, it's only seven shots. That's not bad. That's workable. But man, go lights out on the back nine, Rory, and let's leave that eight in the dust to get back into this tournament. I hope he does, because, you know, you don't want to take yourself out immediately of the British Open on hole one. Royal Portrush in Ireland. Haven't been there since 1951. British Open. It's SB Nation Radio. It's SB Nation AM.